It's past eight, so why don't we go ahead and have the clerk take the roll, and then we're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome.
Representative Bennett. Representative Davidsmeyer.
Here.
Senator DeWitt.
Here.
Senator Kaler.
Here.
Representative Harper. Representative Hernandez. Representative Moeller. Senator Sims. Representative Sosnowski. Senator Staines. Senator Severson. Senator Tracy.
I think that makes it an even fight. All right. Okay, great. Well, thank you. So today's mission with the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability is to go over the executive director's first a report, opening comments from him, and then the economic forecast and revenue estimates for the upcoming year. So welcome, Clayton. It's great to see you. As always, take it away.
Good morning, Co-Chair Staines and Davidsmeyer and members of the Commission. For the audio record, my name is Clayton Klenke. I'm the Executive Director of the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, and I'm joined at the table by our Revenue Manager, Jim Machinsky. We have some limits on member availability this morning, so in light of that, our intention is to move right to our PowerPoint. We'll have Jim walk you through that to provide first an update on our FY20 revenue estimate, and then also our initial look at our FY21 economic forecast and revenue estimate. Before we do that, I would just make two quick notes in regard to our presentation. I just wanted to note that our estimates for the coming year are based on current statutory provisions. We have some slides in there to make comparison to GOMB's number. In some cases, they do have some methodology in their numbers that would require the continuation of some legislative action. The differences between these methodologies, though, are minor, and you'll see that the overall numbers are still very close, especially in terms of the overall number, although there is some variance between the individual revenue sources. Secondly, we've added some additional slides this year to our presentation to provide various scenarios depending on how the final voter outcome comes out on the constitutional amendment on the progressive income tax. So due to these additional slides, as I mentioned, our intent would be to just move right directly into our PowerPoint to begin that. So I'll turn it over to Jim for that unless there's some initial questions.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Before we get into the actual revenue forecast, we'd like to at least present you with some economic measures, observations, and forecast of the national as well as the Illinois economy. We'll begin by looking at page 5, which is a chart that shows the U.S. real GDP. The GDP, of course, is one of the broadest economic measures that gauges the economy in terms of its health. It's comprised of household consumption, business investment, government spending, and net exports. You can see after the recession's end and the expansion, which began around 2009, quarterly data was erratic. But since about 2016, there's been modest but very steady performance. And you can see that we're right at either 2% or just a tick under in some quarters, but it has been very steady. Unfortunately, despite being the longest expansion in modern history, it is also one of the weakest. Page 6 demonstrates the Purchasing Managers Index. It's basically an index indicator of the economic health of the manufacturing sector. And as you can see, over the last 6 months or so, we've kind of bounced between expansion and contraction. There are some that would say the manufacturing sector has been in a recession now for several quarters, but it has yet to bleed over into any other areas of the economy. The much larger component of GDP is that of the non-manufacturing index, and this is shown on page 7. This slide represents approximately 80% of the GDP, and it would include industries such as wholesale, retail trade, transportation, warehousing, information, finance, insurance, real estate, science, and technology. Again, this is on page 7, and you can see that since the expansion began back in 2010, we've had a decade of continued growth. Page 8 gives a little brief overview of inflation, the CPI. I don't think I'm telling you anything here that inflation has been well in check now for quite some time. If you take out the more volatile food and energy, if you look at that red line, you can see we've experienced a pretty tight range there, right at or maybe even slightly above 2%. The U.S. and Chicago CPI has been trending and have now synced up almost perfectly the last couple of measures. So clearly, inflation right now appears to be in check. Page 9 illustrates the Producer's Price Index. This primarily measures goods, services, and construction products purchased by other producers as inputs. It's from the first commercial transaction for many products and some services. It also is fairly low right now, but if you see back in 2018, there was a period where this measure was just at, or if I recall, just over 6%, and there was some pause that eventually this might trickle through to the CPI. However, those fears quickly vanished, and it fell soon after there in the fall of 2018. So right now, looking at the PPI, it would indicate that there's very little in the way of upward pressure in terms of inflationary concerns. Page 10 illustrates where the 10-year Treasury rate has gone as of late. It's a key rate tied to many transactions, particularly home mortgages, and it's considered an indicator of investor sentiment about the U.S. economy. We basically gave up updating this the last few days because it's moved so rapidly. Yesterday, Tuesday, the Fed issued an emergency rate cut of 0.5% designed to cushion the economy. The 10-year yield fell to a new low of just under 1%. Obviously, we don't have that updated slide in here. But despite that, there is still a positive spread between the two-year. I mean, you oftentimes hear of rate inversion and as a precursor to recession. There was a rate inversion back in, I believe it was August, for a short period of time, but it wasn't of a prolonged nature. And even with yesterday's move, at least based on the two-year, other measures may indicate otherwise, but when you take the 10-year minus the two-year, there was still, a 0.3% spread between those two measures. The recent downturn, particularly due to concerns of weakening global economy coronavirus outbreak, as well as the effects of trade policies, were likely the cause for the earlier declines. Illinois exports on page 11. It would probably come as no surprise that the recent trade wars with China have not fared well in terms of Illinois' exports. You can see that since 2018, there's been a downward trend. China, which used to be our third largest exporter, is now fifth. Obviously, the whole virus scare has interrupted those trade agreements with China. Hopefully, when this passes, after the first stage with China has now been agreed to, they'll start purchasing more of the expected goods from the U.S., in particular, some of our Illinois agricultural commodities. Surprisingly, though, Illinois exports did very well during other periods when the economy wasn't faring very well. So, the next few slides demonstrate and explain some various employment measures. I think we all realize that unemployment historically is at a very low level. So a lot of the slides are essentially repeats of one another. I will just make mention perhaps on page 14, which is the Illinois employment, both on a household survey as well as the establishment survey, otherwise known as a payroll survey. It's a little harder data. That Illinois took a couple years longer than the U.S. to recover its jobs lost during the Great Recession, at least on the establishment survey side. From the household survey side, we've actually yet to recover all those jobs lost. Page 15 compares the United States versus the Illinois unemployment rate. This is a nice chart because it really shows that during times of a downturn, Illinois tends to fare slightly worse than that of the nation. So back in 2009, we're the red dotted line, and you can see when the effects of the recession on employment took hold, Illinois actually exceeded the national unemployment rate by about 1.5 to close to 2 percentage points. Then, over the course of the recovery over the next decade or so, we've consistently been between 1.5 and 1% higher. But as of late, we have synced up again with that of the nation. There's very little spread between us and the U.S., and that is further delineated on page 16, which is a bar chart that also shows the Midwestern states as well. They're the red. U.S. is the blue, and we are the black. So again, if you go to 2009, you'll see where the rates started to diverge, with Illinois being considerably higher, both at the depths of the recession and then over the recovery period. But the last couple of years, we have resynced once again, not only with the Midwest, but the nation as a whole. So about 3.5 for the Midwest and about 3.7 for Illinois. So let's now turn to page 17, which discusses future expectations over the forecast period in terms of the economy. IHS Markit is one of the Commission's econometric firms that we utilize, and they provide us with three distinct scenario outcomes. The first is the baseline scenario, and it is considered to be the most likely, represents about 65% chance of occurrence, and it would have the economy continuing at a moderate pace with GDP growth of about 2.3% in 20, slowing, though, in 2021 to about 1.8%. The pessimistic would include about a three-quarter recession starting in the second quarter of 2021. It has a 25% chance of occurrence. And then finally, an optimistic scenario would have growth climbing to 2.7 in 2020 and 2.9 in 2021. I will add that these forecasts are done monthly and have yet to reflect the last couple of weeks of what we know to be considerable uncertainty in terms of the global as well as national economies. We will continue to update this over the next couple of months with the likelihood of having to make another revision potentially in early May as we did last year. But obviously there's a lot of uncertainty. Nobody really knows the impact both globally as well as U.S. and more specifically to Illinois, and we probably won't even know that in a couple months either. We just have to see how things play out. But the point was, these forecasts were done, were given prior to the most recent upheaval. Page 18 just simply provides some narrative and some overall measures to the various specific sectors that that the information IHS Markit provides, GDP growth, consumer spending, monetary policy, and the like. Page 19 is a table which has the correlating measures of the baseline forecast. So again, the very top there, GDP is expected to fall from 2.3 to 1.8. Personal consumption is expected to maintain good levels, just over 4%, and the national employment rate is also expected to maintain a very low level of just over 3.4%, which is just up a tick from their estimate for 2020. Page 20 has the Illinois forecast from IHS specifically. Gross state product also is expected to dip in 2021, as did the national GDP, falling from 2 to 1.2%. Total employment is expected to improve, albeit very slightly, at 0.3% in 21. Population, I mean, everybody knows that we are struggling with our population trends right now, and they continue, the expectation is them to continue to fall slightly. Personal income, though, is expected to maintain just over 3%, and the unemployment rate, while going up slightly, is still very low in terms of historically. I will mention that Moody's Analytics indicates in one of their past reports that 98% of the variation in the Illinois economy is related to the national variations. So while Illinois economy is closely tied to that of the nation, it is in direction of movement, but not through a common rate of growth. So if you were to compare the national versus Illinois measures, you would see them moving in similar direction, but the level of magnitude doesn't necessarily tie closely. Speaking of Moody's, I don't know if you're aware, but a couple of weeks ago, Moody's Analytics produced for the commission their latest version of the Illinois Economy Outlook. That report was put online. It's currently at the print shop being bound, so you will have that in short order. What we did today was at least include a couple of slides related to that report. The first are simply excerpts from the summary, and then the second slide has some other information we thought would be a good pro and con type of review of some of the commentary. Essentially, Illinois, they say, is in decent shape for a state facing a slowdown in manufacturing, poor agricultural conditions, and numerous demographic and fiscal problems. That's essentially the underlying thread throughout most of their commentary, that Illinois, when compared against Illinois of a few years ago, is in a better place, both fiscally and otherwise. The problem is, it looks as though we will continue to underperform relative to the Midwestern states by, they said, a click or a level or something like that, and underperform relative to the nation by slightly more than that. That growth will be constrained by our struggling financial position, condition, whatever you want to call it, as well as our poor demographics. Those comments probably you could have repeated the last couple of years. I mean, it's essentially the same constraints that we felt now for quite some time. But relative to ourselves, not that long ago, they do believe we are in a somewhat better position. Again, the report is online. Please feel free to review it. If you have any questions, we can either attempt to answer them, or we can be in contact with the authors to see if they could provide some more information. Page 23, and we're getting to the revenue forecast. I assure you, I know it's taking a while to get there, but page 23 is a very valuable table in terms of the information it provides. It includes the average employment levels by sector, as well as the average weekly earnings, which is at the bottom. And then we have an aggregation of those rates in the blue line at the very bottom. And as you can see, 2018 was a really good year. In total, we had a 4.7% growth when you combine the wage as well as employment. 2019 has moderated somewhat, but still historically at very strong levels at 3.7%. So these are the types of things that we look at in terms of trying to see the linkage between number of workers, their wages, withholding patterns, state income taxes, those types of things. So for us, this type of an analysis has a good bang for the buck. And it does show that while things have moderated, we're still at very good levels, relative historically at least. Okay, now let's move into the actual revenue component of the presentation. Page 25, before we talk about revisions, let's just quickly review what the budget as enacted back in June of last year was based on. In terms of total general funds revenues, it was $40.287 billion. That did include about $100 million of interfund borrowing. There's a little table on page 26 which breaks out each of those components and gives some value to that. Basically, the way the fiscal year 19 ended, the 2020 estimate would have assumed about $992 million in base revenue growth. While there were some smallish changes via legislation, primarily the base estimates didn't undergo a tremendous amount of change. Most of the big changes related to the capital and those types of things were done outside of the general funds arena. I will say the federal sources were expected to show some considerable growth, and as we'll see in a second, that has not panned out. So, again, the budget, as passed back in June, totaled $40.187 billion in terms of base and $40.287 billion overall. So that was then, this is now. How have revenues performed over the last two-thirds of the fiscal year? Page 27 shows on a month over the prior year, same month period, how revenues have increased or decreased. We show it in two ways, one with federal sources and one without, just due to the volatility that federal sources always brings to the table. Through February, we were able to include just the end of February, just a day or two ago. In total, general funds are up $1.565 billion. Excluding federal sources, it's still up $1.416 billion. How have the major revenue sources performed? Well, on page 28, you'll see that the big three, we like to call them, personal, corporate, and sales tax, have performed quite well. We're up 5.2% through the first two-thirds of the year for personal income tax on a gross level. Excuse me. Corporate income tax is up over 10% and sales tax up over 3%. Now, there's some impact due to the amnesty program because monies from the amnesty program are now included in the lines. When the budget was enacted, the assumption of the $175 million in amnesty proceeds was simply lumped into the other source category, not spread throughout the individual lines. Now that the amnesty program is over, that money has actually filtered into and deposited into those various lines. So that causes some of those percentage increases to be a little bit higher than the base would indicate. If your attention goes down to the middle of the page under transfers, you'll see that the refund fund transfer is up $290 million or 88%. When the budget was passed, it was assumed that only $400 million would be available for such transfer, when in effect, $617 million was actually available for that transfer. So that results in that big percentage change. And then other transfers were up 53%. I don't know if you realize it, but over the course of the last several years, there was a deficiency building up in the transfers from the Capital Projects Fund to the General Fund. This year, it appears as though that there was enough money in the Capital Projects Fund to start working on that backlog, and as a result, we're seeing some good transfer numbers there. Overall, however, the general funds is up 6.8% or $1.565 billion. Page 29 shows the Commission's revised and updated 2020 general funds forecast. Base forecast stands now at $40.129 billion. While that is a slight decrease of $58 million from the base forecast assumed during enactment, when $150 million in interfund borrowing and now $400 million from the Treasurer's investment borrowing is included, it's actually up $392 million. Very quickly, we'll go through some of the major categories here. Income taxes, a slight revision up from the budgeted amounts of $33 million on a net basis. This would include a slight decrease in the forecast of personal income tax, but that's more than offset with the increase in our corporate income tax expectation. Net sales tax have done quite well over the course of the first two-thirds of the year. That's being revised up $172 million. All other state sources are being revised down $161 million, and that's primarily due to more accurately reflecting the new fund distribution changes related to cigarette taxes, as well as some year-to-date weakness in some of the smaller revenue lines, such as inheritance and insurance taxes. And again, the amnesty money has now been parsed back into the appropriate economic lines. So as a result, there's a downward revision in the other source category. Transfers has been increased about $441 million, again, due to two things. One, the refund fund transfer being higher, as well as the transfers from the capital projects fund. But the federal source estimate, and it's really been the bane of estimators the last several years with its fluctuations, appears to be falling well short of the budgeted expectation, and as a result, that forecast is being revised down $543 million. At this time, I don't know how many of you see the monthly revenue briefing and follow that, but you'll note that, and this month will be no different, the volatile swings in federal sources and the impact that has on the bottom line for each month. Through the first two-thirds of the year, despite being up somewhat, when you look at over the last third of the year, what the expectations are, it does not appear at all likely that we would have hit those budgeted expectations. So our forecast for federal sources, and you'll see this in a little bit, is now the same as that as indicated in the governor's budget book. So both we and the Bureau are utilizing a lower federal source estimate. Page 31 just gives more detail by each individual line in terms of how the revisions fall. Again, personal income tax slightly down, but offset by a greater gain in corporate income tax. Sales tax up somewhat, refund fund, other. And then the big fall off there in federal sources of $543 million. So overall, the budget for 2020, from a revenue perspective, is tracking very closely to that of the enacted assumptions, only differing by about $58 million in the base, but close to $400 million to the positive when the other resources in terms of interfund borrowing and treasurer's investment borrowing are included. So I mentioned GOMB. Page 32. We compare our revised forecast with that of GOMB's fiscal year 20 estimate provided in the budget book. And as you can see, our estimate of $40.129 billion base revenues is just slightly higher than that of GOMB, differing by only $89 million. There are some component differences. Net income taxes, we're slightly more optimistic this year than they are. Sales taxes, it's very close, but we're about $25 million below. All other state sources, we're $127 million below their level. And we're just slightly more conservative with our forecast of transfers in. Page 33 shows on a more detailed comparison those values between us and GOMB's budget book, 2020 estimate at the time of the budget book. I'm just trying to see if there's any other $25 million difference in inheritance tax. That, for some reason, simply has fallen short of expectations. That's a very, very volatile source, so oftentimes you'll see some wild swings there. But by and large, the economic sources were a little bit more optimistic for this fiscal year, at least, than that of GOMB. I will make the comment that obviously we know last year we had the April surprise. Both us and the Bureau assume that level of April surprise will not repeat. However, I will make mention that due to favorable market conditions in tax year 2019, a potential stronger than anticipated performance of April final payments cannot be totally dismissed. So while we're not counting on something like that to recur, the potential is out there for slightly better than expected April. Even though both us and the Bureau assume that April will not be good this year, I don't want it to be said that we didn't at least give you the foreshadowing that based on how market conditions performed in 2019, that something positive may happen. which is probably going to fly in contrast with all of the various economic and global uncertainty that we're seeing now. But again, we're talking about final payments. That is based on what has actually happened, not what will happen. So I just wanted to bring that point up. Page 34 now, I believe, is where we left off. Okay. Page 34 is our commission's base estimate for fiscal year 21. And as Clayton had mentioned earlier, we're going to present this in a couple of different ways, but right now we're utilizing base forecast, current law. So with that, the forecast for 2021 is expected to grow $516 million to $40.645 billion over the 2020 update. At this point in time, no interfund borrowing or treasurer's investment borrowing is assumed. The underlying forecast assumes continued moderation in the large economic sources, particularly personal income tax and sales tax, in terms of the underlying growth. Corporate income tax is expected to only grow about 1% in terms of the underlying growth rate. In addition, we are removing the 5% retention of the LGDF monies from net income taxes, as well as a 5% proration from sales taxes. In order for that to remain, legislation would have to be passed to do so. Net sales tax is projected to be close to $9 billion next year, up just over 3% of $272 million. Although the underlying growth rate is expected to only be about 2.4%. So the difference being made up for annualizations assumed from sale of the cannabis, as well as the annualization to the trade-in value change that we made last year, as well as a full year's impact of the marketplace facilitator change, which went into effect January 1st. So again, overall, on page 35, you can see the estimates by specific revenue source. Growth is expected to be 516, totaling $40.645 billion on a gross basis, according to current law. And as Clayton had mentioned, the uncertainty revolves around what will happen in November when voters go to the polls to determine whether the Senate Amendment or Constitutional Amendment 1 passes, which would basically change Illinois' flat income tax to a graduated rate structure in terms of personal income tax. Already passed is Public Act 101.8, which has the new graduated tax structure put in place and will become effective January 1st, should the constitutional amendment pass. We provide on page 36 our valuations of that. We assume that should it go into effect on January 1st, the net impact would be about $1.546 billion to the general funds, to which we would add to the base to arrive at a new total general funds estimate of $42.191 billion. Page 37 just kind of provides a little greater level of detail in terms of where we would see that those changes made. Obviously, it would be in personal income tax with the graduated rate structure. The value there is a net about $1.425 billion. And then corporate income tax, because that rate would also go up, it's estimated that that value would be $120 million or so. Now, they often reference $3.6 billion value assigned to the graduated income tax. Remember, being that we're splitting a fiscal year, this would go into effect January 1st of 2021. You know, you're splitting a fiscal year. So that's what that $1.546 billion represents, is the value that we feel would actually be receded in fiscal year 21. Final payments related to that change wouldn't really be felt until the following fiscal year, the following April. So in essence, what you would have is about 5 months of associated withholding with the higher rates. There's always about a one-month lag. We know that from past experience with tax changes like this. We would have a couple opportunities for estimated payments in the spring, but final payments wouldn't hit until the following April. So that's why it's somewhat less than half as you compare it to an overall full year's value. Now we're going to start comparing our forecast to that of GOMB, and on page 38, before we get into that comparison, I just want to quickly lay out the forecast that they presented in the budget book in a similar way that we do here. In fiscal year 2021, their forecast is for growth of $656 million on a base level. This is on page 38. That's up from their forecast for 2020 on a base of $40.040. You will note that they also include a line similar to the commission in terms of the net impact due to the passage of the constitutional amendment if it's adopted. They're at $1.435 billion overall, but if you look at that little table there at the bottom of page 38, you'll note that their value also includes a governor's assumed $100 million proposed pension contribution should the graduated rate structure go into effect. So really, they're looking at a value of $1.535 billion before that that proposal would move that 100. So then on the next page, page 39, is where we have a true apples-to-apples comparison between our value of the graduated rate structure and that of GOMB. And as you can see, it's very similar, differing only by $11 million with us being just slightly higher. In terms of personal income tax, we're very similar. Corporate income tax, we're slightly higher by $19 million. For the sake of presentation, we went ahead and put $100 million under our designation as well, just so that you could see where things would fall should the governor's proposal be enacted. But again, there's very little differentiation between the projection of what the graduated income tax structure would bring in fiscal year 2021. Page 40 goes into a little bit more comparison and shows that when we compare our fiscal year 21 estimate, with that of GOMB's, we are now $51 million lower than they are in 2021. That $51 million, though, is mitigated somewhat when you do add the $11 million higher estimate of the constitutional amendment and resulting graduated tax if it should pass. So now the differential comes down to only $40 million between the two. Now, there are some differences by component. Income taxes were continue to be slightly more optimistic, lower in our forecast of sales taxes, other sources, and transfers in. But in summary, whether you're comparing base revenue forecasts only or including anticipated revenues associated with the graduated income tax, taken in the context of overall revenues between 40 and 42 billion, the economic and resulting revenue forecasts are viewed as being very similar. Page 41 just goes into more comparison between us and the Bureau relative if the constitutional amendment is adopted. Again, the differential then decreases to about $40 million. Page 42, we went ahead because we didn't know how well-versed members were on what the governor proposes if the constitutional amendment does not pass. And so we've just kind of highlighted, as we understand it at least, how he would propose to kind of backfill that resulting budgetary hole. And as shown in the budget book, Should the $1.435 billion of anticipated revenues not occur, the governor proposes about $1.396 billion in actions to address that shortfall. That would be comprised of $865 million stemming from various appropriation reserves, and about $531 million in assumed transfers or interfund borrowing. Well, since transfers and interfund borrowing kind of enter into the revenue side of the ledger, we went ahead and kind of worked our way through some of his proposals. And in essence, should the graduated tax not pass or go into effect, the governor would propose utilizing or taking $98 million more from local share of revenues related to the LGDF and the transit funds, as well as allowing $300 million in corporate income tax refunds to be then moved into general funds. The resulting impact obviously would be a potential backlog of owed corporate refunds. He would also tap $100 million from the road fund, $30 million from the Open Space Land Acquisition Development Fund, and $3.5 million from the State Police Cadet Class. So those five elements combined comprise the $531 million. It's unclear exactly how these proposals would be enacted, whether it be in the BIMP bill or some other legislative measures, but we wanted to at least spell those few things out as they would be somewhat revenue related should the constitutional amendment fail. And with that, that concludes essentially the revenue projections and estimates.
Great, thank you. Please add Senator Sims, Senator Tracy, Representative Moeller to the roll, and welcome Senator Ellman. Great to see you here as well. So we're going to open up for questions now. I know Senator Kaler had one.
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate that, Jim. It gives us a full scenario of what ifs, and I think that's very helpful. Go back to page 29. Just a question on federal sources when you
yes.
talk about that being down $543 million. What does that mean? Is that we have not gotten some approval from the feds to do certain programs, therefore those programs are eliminated or just not funded? Or does it mean that we have to make that up with GRF?
It probably means that the original forecast assumed that the time the budget passed was simply too high.
Can I add, I believe that this has a lot to do with the Medicaid matching and how we're doing it, and I believe that some of that may just be because instead of getting federal Medicaid match on some making Medicare premiums, they just don't pay us. So there's also an equal reduction in appropriation that we need. So I think that may be a little, I'd like to get into some more detail on that, but I think that may give a little bit of a indication.
Yeah, I think that would be very helpful.
The offset that the senator is talking about, that's been going on for a number of years now. It may factor into this, but the budget, as assumed, probably overestimated the level of federal sources being recouped into general funds. As you know, there are a number of funds that can be utilized to pay Medicaid bills. And depending on out of what funds that spending takes place, usually that's where the reimbursement flows back to. Now, I understand that that may be not as much of a rule of thumb anymore as what it used to be. But also, you have to consider that last year, during the April surprise, much of that federal money, or much of that increased income taxes, was funneled to reimbursable spending. And so not only did we see a large increase in income tax receipts in April, but we also saw a massive amount of federal reimbursements because of the spending that allowed. So with the belief that we're not going to be at or near the levels of last year, neither can we assume that we're going to hit that earlier level of federal reimbursement. But yes, we will look into that and see where the weakness is.
I guess just to simplify it for me, what we're saying though is that we don't have to make that up any place. It may result in either expansion of programs or retraction of programs, right? I mean, it's not like something we have to draw out of the GRF to
to help cover?
It would all depend on how the bills
okay.
are. If there was a backlog of bills, which I don't believe related to this, it's changed much because we've been running at about $7 billion now for quite some time.
Okay.
I think it was just probably a little over-eager estimate of what we would do from a federal source standpoint. And again, we simply, at this point of the year, usually just adopt what the administration assumes that they're spending from their agencies will be able to collect. But federal sources is always tricky because it depends on your appropriation levels, your cash available for spending, your actual programmatic liability that gets entered into the system to be paid, and then ultimately the schedules paid by the comptroller. All of those things can interrupt, delay, accelerate, or just not happen depending on actual performance. So it's a very tricky line for us to forecast.
Right, and the largest part of it is definitely Medicaid matching dollars from the Fed.
About 90% of it is.
And
yes.
And I do believe that we had some Medicare premium payments that are paid from Medicaid that instead of the Feds giving us cash and then us, giving them the premiums back, they just kept it. So then I don't think that has that impact. But I would definitely appreciate your
Absolutely.
Taking a look at that and giving us your analysis on that.
Sure.
Are you, Senator Kaler, any more questions? Senator DeWitt and then Senator Tracy.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a couple of quick questions. Going back to slide on page 12, I think it's great to sing about our low unemployment rate in the state, but do you have any thoughts on where those 100,000 jobs went that were lost on page 12 between...
Manufacturing
jobs. From 2007 to 2020.
You got 12?
Page 12.
Page 12, okay. Where do they went? Where they were lost?
Right.
One of our analyses that we've seen, and in fact I think we're going to update it for the February monthly briefing, is that the higher wage sectors, such as manufacturing, the jobs there, when lost, eventually show up in the lower level sectors not associated with manufacturing. So looking at the number of jobs, you'll see that we continue to go up, but it's where those jobs are. You're kind of moving the deck chairs. You're going from the higher paying manufacturing to the lower level paying, like hospitality, those types of things. Where these manufacturing jobs are going, well, I assume it's competition for producing these types of goods overseas, perhaps other states. I know Moody's made the comment in their report that overseas obviously continues to be a more attractive place for some of these productions of manufacturing type of items to go to. I don't know if that answers your question. It's interesting in that I remember a year ago, we actually saw the manufacturing components show some improvement. We were hoping it was going to be a longer-term trend that it has ended up being. It was fairly short-lived.
So there's no metric that actually tracks, for instance, where a percentage of those jobs, maybe they are now underemployed into the retail.
Well, that would get that kind of gets back to
a metric that tracks where some of those jobs may have.
No, we have no way to tie those jobs.
Would it be wrong to suggest that perhaps some of those jobs have simply gone out of state?
No, I'm sure that some of them have.
Okay.
Yeah,
thank you.
Perhaps out of state, perhaps overseas. But again, manufacturing and the loss of jobs in manufacturing is not unique necessarily to Illinois. Nationally, there's the view that manufacturing has been in the doldrums and perhaps even at recessionary levels for a little while now. So,
thank you. One other question going to page 28 with regards to general fund receipts. I think this issue came up at our last meeting. Were we not going to separately track motor fuel tax revenues? Where are those shown in these revenue projections? Where are they categorized?
Well, the gallonage of motor fuel taxes is not part of this metric. Those are
those are outside of general funds. Now, we do apply the sales tax to motor fuel sales, mm-hmm. and those are part of this.
And where are those shown?
Well, they would be part of sales tax.
Sales tax in general?
It's sales tax in general.
And I think we talked last meeting about the possibility of breaking that motor fuel tax number out so we could track it.
On page 44.
Oh, in the detail? Oh, there it is. Okay.
Well, that would be for all appropriated. So that you're
yeah, that's appropriated.
Yeah, I don't want to conflate the different measures here. One is the gallonage tax. That's the tax that doubled, was the gallonage tax.
Right.
But in addition to the gallonage tax, we have
sales tax.
The sales tax.
Understood.
And that's somewhere between, I don't know, $400 to $500 million a year that we get from sales tax on motor fuel. But that will also go undergo change over the next, I think, 4 years or so.
It'll adjust.
It will adjust. We will remove that from the sales tax by 20% a year until that is.
But the indexing
removed.
Will also increase.
I believe so.
Right.
But to answer your question, motor fuel gallonage tax is not part of the general fund's revenue equation.
Okay. And finally, with regards to the amendment, should it not fail?
Should it not fail or should it pass? Should it not pass?
Should fail. If it should fail. The governor proposes utilizing $100 million from the road fund to cover transit costs. How does that jive with the lockbox?
I'm uncertain as to the...
I believe transit.
In the lockbox? Yeah, mm-hmm.
It's very broad. I mean, extremely broad.
Okay.
Very broad, intentionally when they pass the...
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Of course. Senator Tracy, then Representative Mueller.
Thank you. Going back to the manufacturing question, I was just perhaps not reading that right because, yes, I did understand that we have been losing manufacturing jobs mm-hmm. in a decreasing amount. And when I was looking at the table on 23, I still was trying to understand that where it's average employment levels by subsector. And then, I mean, like with the manufacturing, it looks, I just was trying to figure that with your chart on 12, and then I'm trying to understand the chart on 23.
Well, the charts on page 23 comes from BLS, and the charts on page 12 comes from, they're also from BLS. We'll have to look and see if it's whether one's seasonally adjusted and the other is non-seasonally adjusted. But we can do a little more analytics on that to see where the
okay,
the differences
like I say,
are.
I was just, yeah. To me it was conflicting and I was
right.
having a difficulty understanding it. Then going back to Senator
oh, okay. If you look at the scale from where those tables start, we have page 12 starts in 2007, whereas it starts in 2010 on page 23.
Okay, so we were at 680,000, and then now on the 23 showing that we are at about 592,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But we'll make sure that everything is
okay. And then, following up on Senator Kaler's question, I also was questioning where we're losing the match on those federal funds, and I presumed, of course, as we all did, it was attributed to our Medicaid reimbursements. But if it's even at 90%, I'm wondering the other 10%. It would be interesting to know if you could break that down into what the funding sources are, so that if there's a way that we can maximize the match. If we're lagging or missing that opportunity, wherever that is, it'd be interesting to know how we could maximize those.
And we have a chart we can update on that. Back in 2014, we did a volatility study for the General Assembly, and it includes a chart that lays out by every line and that shows about 90% from the actual Medicaid claims, another 5% from the Medicaid admin costs, and then the other 5%, all the various lines. There's probably another 30 lines that have fallen at another 5%, but that's certainly something we can update with our most recent data for you on that.
All right, thank you. I mean, certainly 5% of that total amount isn't going to be that much, but it'd be still interesting to know if we could somehow maximize that.
I know a lot of that was individual lines, like some related to SNAP and some other programs at DHS, but we can update that for you.
Okay, and then going to page 37, the estimates on if Amendment 1 is adopted, what I'm wondering is if from Department of Revenue, you have income bracket breakdown showing what part is attributable to what bracket within our the anticipated or the past graduated rates?
Yeah, all of that enters into the formalization of those estimates.
Certainly, yes. Yeah. But do you have a breakdown that you could provide us?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll just get it right off of the department's department publishes those income brackets, but we'd be happy to.
Okay.
To
well,
give those
I mean,
to
I
you.
Think yeah, that would be helpful, and I think that concludes my questions. Thank you,
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Oh. Thank you for the presentation. I had just a few questions. The first one is related to LGDF. Can you explain a little bit further the 5% retention? I believe it's on page... it's towards the end. 34. That under existing legislation?
Right. Under existing law, and this went into effect fiscal year 17, I believe. A change was made in that the amount of income tax that flowed through the LGDF fund, instead of flowing through the formula, they decided to go ahead and deposit it specifically to the locals in LGDF. Mm-hmm. However, at the same time, because of the state's fiscal issues, at the first year, 90% proration was applied to that. So in other words, the state kept 10% of what otherwise would have gone to the locals. That was changed in each of the last 2 years to 5% retention. So the state is keeping 5% of what otherwise would have flowed to the locals. But each year, if that were to continue, a legislative change needs to take place. So under current law, without doing anything, that goes away, and the state would no longer retain that 5%.
And in follow-up on that, and then you can go on page 40, then, when you do the comparison of COGPA versus GOMBI, because that was going to be one of my questions, that's not an apples-to-apples comparison in that either, correct?
It's slightly off because of that factor. That
so if you did, if you assumed what the governor's budget and, you know, GOMBI is assuming in terms of the 95%, your revenue estimate would be $74 million higher.
You would have to go up a little bit because of that 5%.
Isn't that $74 million? Isn't that what I think I saw?
It would be $74 for personal income tax and corporate income tax, and approximately another $25 million, I believe, for sales tax.
So that's okay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that's just something that we all need to understand. So when you mm-hmm. say you're $40 million lower here or 51 mm-hmm. before, it's you're really higher on the comparison basis with that.
Very slightly, yes. That's why I know we 25, 50, I mean, obviously that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I always try to break it out into the context of a $40 billion budget. The underlying economic outlooks, very similar.
No, I understand, but, you know, we do it down to
absolutely.
Given our state budget challenges, we usually get down to those last dollars. So.
Absolutely.
All right, sorry, Representative Mueller.
No, that's okay. Thank you. And then, if the constitutional amendment fails, then that it's contemplated that policy would continue plus additional, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. The $136 million reduction in other sources, is that related to, and I'm looking for the page that was listed, is that on page 35, the estimates.
Right.
From budgeted to actual. Are those the federal resources that we're talking about, or is that something different?
No. Other sources there, that $136 million, that represents the expected change between 2020 and 21, and that really is the net number after you factor out the $193 million of one-time deposits this fiscal year from a manufacturing drug court case that was recovered by the AG's office.
Okay.
So it kind of makes this year artificially high that won't repeat, and
okay.
So you have that expected fall off for fiscal year 21.
Okay, so that was a one-time revenue.
Right.
Okay. And then are cannabis sales taxes included in the general sales tax category, or are those separate?
The regular old sales tax... Yes, cannabis sales are included in that. I think we've annualized it for next year, somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 million, $50 million for next year.
Okay.
But in addition, in the other transfer line, and we'll keep on your page 35.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other transfer line, the 846, contains $46 million in actual transfers
mm-hmm.
from the Cannabis Regulation Fund.
Okay.
And then in 2020, we're assuming $15 million. To be transferred from the Cannabis Regulation Fund into that line.
Okay. And then one more question. I know it's early, and I'm not asking you to provide any definitive predictions, but with what's happening with COVID-19 and how we've already seen a little bit of an impact here in the state, are your colleagues around the country or in the industry adding this new possibility of, you know, volatility impact to the economy with what's happening with the...
Well, the measures that we've utilized to produce this forecast simply for timing purposes did not
sure.
contain any of those measures.
Right.
As the next couple of months go by, I'm sure we'll start seeing mm-hmm. some revisions to the forecast. On an ad hoc basis, I know some financial institutions were saying that the first quarter would probably be reduced to a little over 1% growth from 2%, but the second and third quarters may be flat. No one has yet indicated going into a negative territory, but obviously we're so early in what's happening, we don't know what necessarily will happen. Certainly, the supply chain has been interrupted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to what extent built-up inventories prior to this are able to accommodate, we don't know.
Yeah.
Again, you don't know if the reports out of China, how correct they are.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw something yesterday that said while industry was shuttered up for quite some time, right now about 90% of the factories were opened at least in some capacity,
mm-hmm.
And they thought about 70% production capacity was close to happening. Don't know if that's true or not. Those are just reports coming out of there.
Right.
But clearly, anytime, you know, for example, you have a manufacturing assembly plant here in Illinois,
mm-hmm.
we can't assemble our product because our parts come from China. We don't have those parts from China. So things start to get interrupted.
Right.
To the extent there's a makeup capacity,
mm-hmm.
obviously that would mitigate that, but it all comes down to capacity
mm-hmm.
and the ability to make up for that shortage. The bottom line is we simply don't know at this early stage
what impacts
would be.
Yeah, we'll be keeping an eye on that. So thank you.
All right, other questions? No, I just have a couple, too. Most of my more detailed questions have been answered or already asked. Thanks. On the big picture, similarly, you know, obviously what's been happening in the last month with the COVID-19 and then also what's happened with the Tino way drop that you sort of referenced, I'm presuming when you come back in early May is when I think I hear you saying, what's
if,
the timeline that you're likely to do an update?
If an update is required, it would probably be in early May.
And it's likely to be more on the downside, I would assume.
I would assume, given those,
that would be your expectation
right.
if we're going
that
to
That would be, the
expectation
at this time.
I also saw in the Moody's Analytic report, just it looked like and I just wanted to see if you could elaborate on this a little bit, that the minimum wage increases, they don't have huge expectation that that's going to have much of an impact on any economic growth or anything like that. That, and one of the other things that I had noted was, that actually surprised me, quite frankly, was that our sort of business outlook compared has been looking better relative to other states. And one of the surprising in my positive sides is that, you know, our business costs have been getting better. What are the indications of that getting better? I know our overall outlook is problematic because of our demographics and our budget uncertainty. But in terms of our business costs, it seems like that was getting better relative to others. And I did not understand what was driving that.
Well, to back up to your first observation, yes, in terms of the minimum wage, Moody's indicated that Illinois was one of, I think it was 21 states who underwent some type of a minimum wage increase in the beginning of 2020. Some of those states, by law, are indexed, so they automatically go up. But I think there were, seven who actually had legislative changes to do that. I know Missouri was one of them as well. They felt that because other states also are increasing their minimum wage, that at least initially, the impact to Illinois was fairly minimal, one way or another. They didn't really indicate in what direction. They said it was minimal. Now, your second question had to do with, again, I'm sorry, what was?
The business cost.
Oh, the business cost.
They talked about
right. That
actually getting better in Illinois, and I just didn't understand. I don't think I saw in there, or if you have any knowledge about what was driving that.
Well, I think what they were referencing there is, despite labor being relatively higher in the state of Illinois, other factors that at one time were higher actually have moderated somewhat. I think in terms of the cost of energy, I believe, public utilities. Oh, no, energy cost, I believe, was better than what it was before. Tax burden, and this all depends on how the measure is calculated, but perhaps we're a little bit better than what we had indicated in prior reports that they put out. They have us ranked 98 in terms of tax burden, which is somewhat lower than Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Labor costs, we continue to be slightly higher, but overall we're kind of in the middle of those Midwestern states.
And so the general sense is that's not so much the problem as our fiscal uncertainty and our demographics.
Those are definitely the two largest drivers that Moody continually indicates throughout the report.
Senator Keller?
Yeah, that's a good observation. I think energy costs are down, and that's one of the things. I mean, Illinois is the only restructured state in the midst of all the Midwest, so we have a free market for purchasing electricity, and I think that has some impact. We've been long known as a low-cost energy state. But on the minimum wage, can you, this is getting real specific, but this happens to do with a bill I have in trying to help small employers with minimum wage increases, but can you give us an estimate of what the minimum wage increase might have, what the impact it might have on the personal income tax? I mean, it's going to be small, but what is there an increment of additional income tax that's going to be paid to Illinois based on an employee having a higher
wage? Yeah, that level of analytics isn't something that we're able to parse out and distill it down to that level. I know there may be some regional econometric modeling that universities perhaps could undergo that might render output on that. I think the Department of Revenue they've looked at that at least last year to determine what the net impact of that may be.
Is that a question I should ask them?
They would have the modeling ability to perhaps do that type of breakout.
I mean, what I'm looking for is a rationalization of a funding source to offset some additional benefits to employers who are given increases. So
what? Obviously, the increase just went into effect in January. So everything that you would forecast would be based on some assumption.
Okay.
We like to deal more with actual data points, and clearly we haven't had any yet, nor will we now for probably a year that we can start distilling. But what we would plan to do is look at how trends on those lower level sectors perform relative to where they were prior to the minimum wage mm-hmm. increase, and then after, maybe compare it to some other sectors, and to see if there's some observation that can be made in terms of impact. But unfortunately, that all works the best when everything is static.
Yep.
And now with the current uncertainty,
right.
that kind of will
right.
throw that into yeah, high right. level of uncertainty as well.
I understand. Well, this is maybe a discussion we can have next year.
Okay.
Senator Ellman?
I just wanted to touch on that, too. I've been curious about the impact of minimum wage increases on sales tax, because I assume that that spending will occur at those income levels. The consumer spending will increase at a greater rate.
It would be assumed that those individuals who are under the minimum wage category tend to spend as much as they take in. And so if there would be an impact, yes, it would probably be seen in sales tax. Unfortunately, when you look at it from the overall standpoint of a $9 billion revenue line, it's very difficult to distill those unique components to it.
And as we look at the minimum wage and the, you know, we're at the beginning of the ramp up of minimum wage, so I wouldn't expect that we'd see a great return. We'd see a little bit more withholdings in payroll taxes, right? But the earned income tax later will kind of offset some of that.
Yeah, I mean, we're so early in the process now, there's simply no data points that we could hope to identify. Perhaps as we move forward, maybe the Department of Revenue, because of their proprietary database, can do some individual runs. Obviously not showing anybody's tax returns, obviously, but you know, maybe by income level they could do some individual runs to see how things have progressed. If there's a way to identify and distill those impacts, that's a possibility.
Senator Severson?
Along the same lines, is there a way to track the loss of minimum wage jobs? How many minimum wage jobs do we have in Illinois quarter over quarter? I mean, we know that you know, park districts and school districts, and they're all laying off. They're not hiring minimum wage jobs anymore. So the question would be: is there a way to track under the employment category minimum wage jobs and track as the minimum wage goes up the loss of those jobs of those people that we say we want to help?
Well, unfortunately, even getting a reliable number on the number of minimum wage job holders right now, it's very difficult. I would go back and looking at those sectors who are most likely to be paying the minimum wage and to see how their employment levels are performing perhaps differently than other sectors who have a higher usual, you know, weekly wage. And if you start seeing those diverging, perhaps then you might be able to draw some conclusions from that. But to put a finite number on those amounts would be very difficult for us to do. Perhaps IDES has the ability to do something like that. But
yeah, maybe they could. That would be, because I think that would be an interesting number. And I did notice on the employment on 23, page 23, why we had 1% employment growth. Kind of frightening was the massive growth of government, increase of 7,000 jobs year over year, and in education. So it looks like a couple of those, without the growth in government jobs, our overall employment level would have been under 1% increase. So that's, I don't know which governments are hiring, added 7,000 people, but that's... That's an interesting number.
Anything else, Senator Severson? And just to note, if you go to the Moody's Analytic report on page 6, they did say statewide the impact of raising the minimum wage will be marginal. I mean, that was their assessment for what that's worth. All right, any other questions? Then this has been very informative, very helpful. Very much appreciate it. And with that, we will adjourn Commission on Government Forecasting Accountability. Thank you very much.